Yeah, it would be sometime, yeah.
Next week, or?
House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 1534. Chris?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1534.
I'm sorry. I said House Bill. The actual correct title is Senate Bill 1534, and that's what I intended to open. Please, Chris.
Senate Bill 1534 has been referred to as the cleanup bill. It contains mostly technical fixes. It's similar, though not identical, to House Bill 4004, which the committee heard earlier in the session. In OLIS, you have two amendments. There's a dash 9 and a dash 10, and you have all of the relevant paperwork. I do have a cheat sheet in here called Senate Bill 1534A and amendments. So I can either walk through that now, or if you want to...
I think it would be great to walk us through.
Let me get it up here.
We're talking about a whole bunch of semi-dissociated amendments, aren't we? Because the bill was so complicated to start with.
Correct. And there is, the Senate version does contain one policy change.
Okay. And we need to know about that. And we have, I know you have two amendments listed as well.
Yes. And so in the cheat sheet that I have, Senate Bill 1534A and amendments, it contains tables for all the A version and the two amendments. Try and facilitate just looking at one document to talk about the changes before you.
Okay.
So just walking through the A engrossed version of the bill, in section one of the bill pertains to the medical subtraction that was created in the special session or changed from the medical deduction. And there are two technical changes there. One, it clarifies an IRC reference. And the second is it cleans up the phase-out bracket for the deduction. There was an amount of $100,000 or $200,000 that wasn't included. It was kind of in a no-man's land with respect to the phase-out. Both of those were in 4004.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Before he moves on, the IRC, Internal Revenue Code reference?
Yes. That, it just makes it more specific. The bill itself... pull that up. Instead of saying referencing section 213A, it references section 213.
So I will admit I haven't spent my night reading IRC 13. And Chris, I'm sure you have. What is the reference? What is this section of the Internal Revenue Code?
This is the section in the Internal Revenue Code related to the medical deductions that are allowed on Schedule A. So basically, if the medical, rather than coming up with a new definition of what constitutes a valid medical deduction, we are using the IRC, the Internal Revenue Code definition, and that's what's in 213.
Okay, thank you.
Then sections 2 through 4 pertain to the IC disc. The one clarification or one correction there is, as the committee recalls, this is the provisional law that created a tax on certain disbursements and a corresponding deduction and subtraction in the chain of transactions relating to IC discs. The version of the bill that passed in October, that this 2.5% tax applied to all IC discs, and the intent was to have it only apply to IC discs created prior to 1/1/14. So this makes that correction. And then the other changes in sections 3 and 4, it aligns the tax, the deduction, and the subtraction so that all of the various parties involved in the transaction only get the deduction or subtraction or pay the tax if all three of these devices get used. So the deduction is allowed only if the subtraction is allowed and the tax is imposed. The way it was drafted before, there was the possibility due to timing of difference in tax years between entities. One entity could have a calendar year and another entity could have a fiscal year. And the way it was tied before to tax years, it could line up that either the tax was imposed and then the deduction and subtraction were not allowed, or the other way around, where the tax was not imposed and but the deduction and subtraction were. So the changing of all this basically moves from a tax year eligibility reference to a transaction period reference. So any transactions that occurred in 2013 and beyond.
Okay. All right.
Section 5 relates to cigarette taxes and just directs the confirms that the revenue goes to the general fund. That was the same that you saw in House Bill 4004. That was just a mission in the bill from October.
And that was part of the summary of the bill that we received on the floor, wasn't it? That it would go to the general fund and be dispersed from there.
Right. There was a subsection was not referenced, so that's getting referenced now to direct that money to the general fund.
So this simply corrects an error in the drafting.
Correct. Section 6 of the bill relates to the non-passive income. It aligns the definition of material participation to the federal definition and links directly to the IRC. So we have an exact IRC reference in statute, and there's some wording in there that's getting deleted. The words being deleted refer to day-to-day operations. That's not part of the federal IRC. So just to be clear that when Oregon uses the concept of material participation, we're referring to the concept that is already well established in at the federal level.
Okay. And that was part of the heartburn that the accountants had, isn't it?
Yes.
Because they were having to deal with two different definitions. The one that we had written without any case law to support it.
The way we had it was just different enough to be a nuisance.
Yeah. Okay.
The second one makes the preferential rates for the non-passive income an opt-in program instead of an opt-out program. Then Section 7, there is a waiver and penalty in the bill, and the intent was to limit it to any tax changes due to the bill that was passed in October because we were in the 10th month of the tax year. So it was conceivable that if any underpayment of tax were due without this waiver, then there could be a penalty in interest. So DOR was given the authority to waive penalty in interest. However, it was not limited to tax year 2013. So this limits that to tax year 2013.
That's a problem.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. This is the normal provision we have in bills that might remotely have an effect on a person's past behavior that they can't fix.
Correct.
When we make a change.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay.
It's standard language in that sense. Sections 8 through 10 are the policy change that the Senate considered. As part of the phase-out or the elimination at the higher income levels of the personal exemption credit in the special session bill, it included the elimination for those taxpayers of the tax credit for taxpayers with a severe disability and those with a disabled child. And what this provision does is reinstate those full amounts. How it got caught up together is that the state has these two separate tax credits, severe disability and disabled child tax credits. The amount of those credits are measured by the personal exemption credit. So they're indexed to that, so there's not a separate calculation. The taxpayers basically get an extra personal exemption credit for the severe disability of the spouse or taxpayer. And they can also get an extra personal exemption credit for every disabled child. So that the kind of nexus with personal exemption credit created some confusion. But they are separate credits. So this just reinstates those two tax credits at the higher income level. So, for example, you can have a taxpayer with $500,000 of income. And under current law right today, they do not get the personal exemption credit. So if we have an example, a single taxpayer with a severe disability, under current law right now, they do not get their personal exemption credit, and they do not get their severe disability credit. With the provisions included here, they would get their severe disability tax credit. They still would not get the main personal exemption credit. They would just get the severe disability tax credit.
Representative Berger.
Okay, Chris. So... we're talking not just about disabled child, but it could be a disabled spouse.
Correct. Correct.
So we're not excluding that. And how is that then calculated? It is the usual calculation? I mean, how much of an exemption are they going to get?
Well, each year, the personal exemption credit is indexed to inflation, and right now it's around $190.
So they would get the usual exemption?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I understand. And that is retroactive here, going back
to 2013.
So nobody's going to lose it?
No.
Okay.
Some taxpayers may need to file an amended return.
Amended return.
They've already filed their 2013 tax return.
Got it. Okay.
Sections 11 and 12, I believe you have testimony coming up here shortly, signed up, that, and I think you'll be able to better answer questions on that. But it deals with reciprocity tax exemption between Oregon and Washington, and it has to deal with two bridges.
Yes.
And there was language that was accidentally deleted in 2007, and the Washington Department of Revenue sent some entities in Oregon a tax bill. So this just reinstates the exemption or the reciprocity agreement, the language that was deleted, and it's retroactive to 2008.
Okay.
And you have somebody who can go into much better detail than what I just provided.
Was that a 2007 bill?
It was a 2007 bill.
Okay. One more place we needed work on a 2007 bill. They keep coming up. Please, go ahead.
Well, that's the A engrossed bill.
Yes.
So moving on to the Dash 9, this one provision was in House Bill 4004, and it relates to non-passive income, and it adds clarifying language that the preferential rates are limited to Oregon-sourced revenue, Oregon-sourced income. The intent of the policy was to provide a tax incentive for Oregon businesses with this lower rate structure. And there is language in there that talks about non-residents and part year that get at kind of the apportioning of income or the Oregon source. The main body didn't have language that limited it specifically to Oregon sources. It didn't actually say that. So there's some potential for something happening in the rulemaking process that wouldn't necessarily align with the policy. So that's included as a Dash 9. That was originally in what was going into 1534. There were some concerns about that on the Senate side, so it got pulled out of the Senate version, which is why it's not in the A engrossed. And that's also why it's in its own standalone amendment here as opposed to being included with the other provisions.
And, of course, the point was that of the bill, or at least that part of the bill, was encouraging job development in Oregon. Does this actually change the policy or simply clarify what we all thought was in the original bill? What's your sense of it?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I think that's an unfair question of staff because the fact of the matter is this was not clarified in the special session. This was not really discussed or vetted as a policy decision. It may have been your understanding, but it certainly wasn't my understanding that this was explicit. Mm-hmm. And so I can understand why this is controversial in the Senate, and it should be controversial here. If this is what we intended, then this is what we needed to say. And I wonder, Chris, if you've got a fiscal on this particular amendment.
Vice Chair Berger, there's no revenue impact to it because when the revenue impact was put together, that was implicit in the calculations.
In other words, the staff made that assumption during the special session without it being explicit, and now we want to rubber stamp that explicit.
Right, and it gets wrapped up in the concept of material participation, and I think why it didn't specifically come out is it kind of got wrapped up in material participation because presumably if you have a business owner who is actively involved in the business, they would be in the state, but there are potential border issues. So I think that's why it didn't come up. The reason there's no revenue impact is because that was embedded implicitly in the assumptions of the revenue impact.
Thank you. Thanks for the discussion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You know how I feel about this whole...
No, actually, I don't. But,
well, I think that we did tax policy too quickly without proper vetting during the special session, and as a result, these kinds of questions then come up as policy decisions later. That.
Yeah. Thank you. And I, in fact, do understand you have said that several times, and it's very difficult to disagree with that.
Well, I'm emphasizing it now.
Yeah, I would simply note that any time we write a big tax bill, we usually take three sessions to make sure it's working correctly. So that's the pushback, if there is one. I don't know that there's a way of fixing that general problem. I think we're sort of stuck with it, and we have to operate in as good a faith as we can manage going forward on all these issues. Other discussion of the Dash 9 while we're listening to Chris describe these pieces to us? If not, let's go ahead and hear the Dash 10.
The Dash 10 contains three provisions that we believe not to be as controversial, and that's why they're lumped in together. Sections 13 and 14 were in House Bill 4004, or an amendment to that bill. And the first one relates to non-resident income from Oregon sources on waterways. This was in a bill from the 2013 session. It was considered a technical fix suggested by DOR. The word on gets changed to in, and it has to do with navigable waters.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking of our high school students that we're down to a discussion of one word and volumes of statute.
Mm-hmm. Well, they sometimes get graded down if the grammar's not quite right.
Yeah, so right.
One assumes that we should, too. So what's the import, if any, of that change?
I think the Department of Revenue is in the room. They might be able to answer that question.
Well, let's go ahead and finish this, and then we'll hear from them on. You've got three more items, I think.
The Section 14 has to do with reporting penalties that were established in 2013 in House Bill 2464. And the amendment deletes a lot of text and then rewords it and adds it. So there's a lot of deletion and a lot of addition. What it does, in effect, is limit the penalties to W-2s. The way it had been drafted before was accidentally broader in terms of referring to a larger section. So the penalty could have been applied to quarterly reports and the like. And the intent was to limit it to W-2s and a year-end truing up, if you will. And so those are applicable for 2014 and forward. In Section 16 is something I don't think this committee has been encountered before. It relates to House Bill 3453, which is the local county emergency surtax. It doesn't currently exist. It was created in 2013. It gives the governor the ability, in consultation with local governments, to establish an emergency surtax. And the language that was included didn't address the issue of apportioning income for part year and non-residents within that local area. So not the traditional part year non-resident that we're familiar with at the state level, but somebody who lives in one of these counties for part of the year and could have lived in Oregon or not in Oregon for other part of the year. So this ties to the apportioning that we do at the state level, just takes that concept and applies it to the surtax. If it gets imposed, then this apportioning would also occur.
You simply add a subsection that says that.
Correct.
Right. Right. And at this point, it doesn't actually affect anything because there isn't any such tax.
Correct.
Imposed. It's available, but not imposed.
Correct.
Right. Okay. All right. Any other questions for Chris on the description? Thank you. Let's go ahead then and hear from Mark Landauer. For convenience, why doesn't the department come up too, and in case we have questions? Mr. Landauer, thank you for coming this morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Public Ports Association, and I'm here to speak to Sections 11 and 12 of the bill that's before you, found on page 6. Since the late 1940s, the Bridge of the Gods, owned by the Port of Cascade Locks, and the White Salmon Bridge, which is owned by the Port of Hood River, have operated tax-exempt due to laws enacted by the states of Washington and Oregon. Those laws worked in tandem, essentially meaning that Washington would exempt Oregon bridges from taxation if Oregon would do the same. However, during the 2007 session, legislation was passed that effectively modernized Oregon's tolling statutes. In that bill, which was just passed out to you, Senate Bill 1022, you'll see in Section 19 there was a statute that was repealed. That was the statute that worked in tandem with Washington's law. That was an inadvertent repeal, and we are now seeking to get that placed back into statute and to make it retroactive. Why would we have to do that? Well, as Legislative Fiscal described, in December of last year, the two ports received letters from the Washington Department of Revenue notifying them of their intent to conduct an excise tax audit to determine any business, occupation, public utility, sales, use, taxes that those ports owed to the state of Washington as a result of the repeal that took place in 2007. Coincidentally, the effective date of that bill in 2007 was January 1, 2008. That's why Section 12 makes the Section 11 retroactive back to January 1, 2008. In any event, this language was essentially put this reciprocal language back into statute, make it retroactive. And I would note that in OLIS, the Washington Department of Revenue has stated that if the Oregon legislature does in fact pass this, they will discontinue their audit and consider that the statute was never repealed back in 2007. I'd simply like to close by thanking the Department of Transportation, DOJ, the Department of Revenue, and the Governor's Office in working with us to get to this point, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Landauer? I'm sorry that I'm having trouble finding this.
The repeal itself.
The date change. Am I looking in the wrong place?
Oh, this is the old bill. That's the bill that repealed.
That is the bill. 1022 was the bill in 2007 that actually repealed.
Okay. That's why we got this. All right.
Yes.
I'm looking in the wrong place.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, right. And so what this amendment does is goes back to the old language and says, oops, we really meant this. Instead, starting at the time of the original repeal in 2008.
Well, it, as a matter of fact, I think that the repeal itself of ORS 381-820 was an inadvertent repeal. It should have never been repealed in the first place.
I gotcha. Thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I'd like to note that I don't think I was on that committee. There were 24 statutes repealed in this one piece of legislation. I apologize for any who were that might have missed it.
We'll figure out which committee that went through.
Yeah.
Okay. I was taking the blame for it. It may, in fact, have been the Transportation Committee.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
And
all right.
24 repeals.
Good. Good. Well, we made plenty of mistakes in 2007. It's nice to blame a different committee for this one.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Do we have questions for the department? I think I asked one, and I can't remember what it was.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue, and you had a question about Section 13 and the non-resident source income from on waterways, the change from on to in. It's conforming with federal law. Federal law already requires this, and this is a change because of sovereign waters inside Oregon. It used to be that a person who worked on a vessel on navigable waters in Oregon, as long as they were working on, like, the Columbia, it was exempt from taxation. As soon as they came down onto the Willamette or down into the Oregon coastal ports, it was no longer exempt from taxation because it was sovereign to Oregon. The federal government said, no, we want it to be like Amtrak, which is like the truck drivers. They get to go. If they're working in multiple states, then they get to exempt it other than in their state of domicile. So this is conforming to the federal change and treating it very similarly to the way Amtrak works for truck drivers. If they are working on the navigable waters in more than one state, then they get to exempt the income.
Yes. So the in modify is really a reference to the states directly rather than simply the fact that they're on the river.
Correct.
Right. Thank you. I finally get it. Appreciate that. Other questions for the department? Thank you very much. We appreciate it. Does anyone else want to be heard today at the public hearing on Senate Bill 1534? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1534 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1534. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 9 amendments into House Bill 1534A.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the dash 9 amendment. Is there any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, it's so ordered. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 10 amendments to Senate Bill 1534A.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the dash 10 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing none, it's so ordered. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1534A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 1534A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Hearing no objection, the motion carries. I'll carry the bill. That will close the work session on Senate Bill 1534 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1541.
Thank you, Chris.
And Chris, thank you very much for mm-hmm. that great explanation on the other bill. Complicated piece. You will sit with me on the floor. Thank you. Please.
Morning, Chair, members of the committee. This is a work session for Senate Bill 1541, which in essence is basically reinstating the tax credit for crop donations and increasing the percentage of the wholesale price that's allowed as amount of credit. The original bill was Senate Bill 1541 that would increase the amount of tax credit from 10% to 15%. And this is a bill that's come from the Senate, and it was given a due pass there. I think all members of the committee know there is a dash 1, 2, 3, but I think the request was to focus on Senate Bill 1541. And last but not least is there's a policy purpose statement that's part of the revenue impact draft language. If you have any suggestions or comments on the policy purpose, if you'd like to amend it in any way to reflect the intent, welcome to get your comments.
What was it again?
It's right at the bottom there to increase. That's the statement.
To increase the amount. Okay.
So we welcome any input or suggestions on changing the language if this is not acceptable.
Right. You recall, colleagues, this is a part of our normal policy that we adopt a policy or we expect the drafting of a policy statement that explains why we accepted the normal rule and established a tax credit. So if anyone has concerns, Representative Bailey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you looking for a motion at this point?
I'll move.
Representative Berger, please.
Are we in work session?
We are.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1541 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 1541 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
To my motion. Representative Vance,
please.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no on this, and not because I don't support the bill. I do. It's just that I think it's far too little given the good it could accomplish. And I thought we heard some great testimony from folks that are engaged in trying to make this work, and I just think it's inadequate, so I'll be a no. I'll give it some more thought before it makes its way to the floor, but I certainly would have supported something larger.
Thank you. Other discussion? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would say that I believe that there is probably some unanimity on this committee in the sense that we would all like to see as strong an incentive as possible towards crop donation, and that I think we all share a strong desire to fund the tools that will help to end hunger in the state of Oregon. I think this is a good step forward on that path, and I think we'll see what effect this level has on that donation, and I think it keeps it in balance with the other tools that this state has to be able to address hunger and poverty in the state of Oregon. So I would share the sentiment that I think we need to do more. I think this is a good step forward.
Thank you. Representative Bailey, Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll also support the bill, but with the same reservations that Representative Bentz brought up. I'll support it, though, because it includes the percentage that the proponents originally asked for. So I want to honor their request in that regard, even though I, at the first hearing, interim hearing back in rural communities, I said, guys, I think this is too small to make a difference. But because they've done the work and they've gone through the process, I'll support them.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Conger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had maybe a general observation about the process that we go through when we're approving things like this. It's the missing piece for me is some kind of way to evaluate the effectiveness of the different kinds of support the state provides for a program like this. As Representative Bailey mentioned, you know, there are other things that the state is engaged in to help feed hungry people. This is one way to do that, but I feel like in some sense we operate in a vacuum because we don't have any comparative information to say this really works, this doesn't, this costs the state more than maybe the return, or doesn't return more to the public in the form of public benefit than the expenditure by the state. And I know some of those, in many cases, that's probably difficult and somewhat subjective to try to estimate those things, but not in every case. And at any rate, that's maybe a criticism of the process. I think I will join Representative Bentz in voting no, but I have to agree that this is, you know, this is difficult because I think certainly don't want the program to fail, but I do think it should be increased, and I have a sense that it would pay off in terms of benefit to increase it.
Mm-hmm. I want to speak to that question. I have met with the proponents of this bill probably more than I've met with the proponents of any bill in the last several years, first in Lane County and then here. And I raised exactly the same issue that you raise with them. It occurs to me that this is a fairly clear example where you can do basically an N of one study on the effect of a tax policy. Because we had a tax policy in place, we let it expire, and now we're adopting a new one that will be in effect for several years. I've asked the proponents to go gather information on what the state of the donations from farmers was before the end of the previous tax policy, what it's been during the time that we haven't had a tax policy in place, and then to keep track of what it will be in the future. And also suggested that perhaps there might be a professor or a graduate student in the Agricultural Economics Department at Oregon State that might, in fact, want to use this as a case study to figure out exactly the answer to your question, whether this actually does something useful or not, whether, what information could we learn that would suggest that we might do something more or less to actually get the outcome we want, which, of course, is feed more hungry people.
Right.
And do it in a way that allows farmers to be helpful in the process. So I really appreciate your comment, and I let you know that I had it too, and I have the assurances from the proponents of the measure who talked with me that they will devise a way to get us as much information as they can so that our successors in 2019, considering, or 2017, considering this renewal of this tax credit, will have that data. And I would recommend to the committee at that point, whoever they are, that they ask for it at that time so that they can actually learn what the effect of this is, recognizing there are all kinds of other things going on at the same time that may affect it.
Sure.
Thank you. Other discussion? I would simply add, I agree with the other people who have spoken, that it seems to me that having a larger credit might have a bigger effect. I don't know that for a fact, but it might. The problem, of course, is that we have to balance this activity against everything else we do. And as in consultation with the Ways and Means Committee process, this appears to be the amount that we can afford right now. And so that's the reason for moving ahead with this bill rather than trying to go to something bigger. And I don't object at all to anyone who says it ought to be larger. I think this is what we can afford, and let's see how it works. Anything else? All right, so we better call the roll. And the motion is on the sending this bill to the floor with a due pass. Senate Bill 1541.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Conger?
No.
Representative Davis?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Bailey?
Aye.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Berger?
Aye.
Chair Barnhart?
Aye. The motion having received the required majority is adopted. The bill goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I'll carry that bill as well. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1534, and we'll open an information meeting on the ODOT Highway Fund forecast. Thank you all for coming today. I hope you learned a little bit about your legislature. And I'm talking to the students from Lebanon High School. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, committee members. For the record, Jerry Bohart. I'm the Transportation Development Division Administrator. And I'm actually going to turn the presentation over to Daniel Porter. He is one of our senior economists.
Just a moment. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 1541. I misspoke a minute ago, and so we need to get the record straight. Having done that, let's go back to you, please.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, committee members. Jerry Bohart with the ODOT Transportation Development Division Administrator. I'm actually going to turn the presentation over to Daniel Porter. He's one of our senior economists at the agency, and he's been instrumental in working on the ODOT revenue forecast. So I'll be here to answer any questions at the end.
Great. Thank you, Jerry. Good morning, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dan Porter, and as Jerry said, I'm an economist with the Department of Transportation and Transportation Development Division. So we are here today to give you an update on the ODOT State Highway Transportation Revenue Forecast. So it's been about a year, since we've been before this committee. So just to give you a quick kind of update on how this is put together, we do our forecast every 6 months, so twice a year on a June and December cycle. And we're consistent with DAS's Office Economic Analysis Forecast of the same name. So this forecast we're giving you an update on today is our December 2013 forecast, and that then matches up with Office Economic Analysis December 2013 forecast. In so much as their outputs from their models, we use as inputs into our transportation models, and we use the same macro kind of national data that they use, so that we're all starting on the same page. So we're not developing our own forecasts for employment and income. We're using what they're providing for us. So look at our first slide. What we're giving you is a snapshot of 2013-15 revenues, and we're giving them gross revenues by allocation. So we expect to bring in about $2.3 billion in gross revenues over this period. And what we do first is that we take those revenues and reduce them by the collection and program costs which is like the staff and supplies for the offsets that revenue. So the people who generate them. So this is DMV costs, this is motor carrier costs, this is fuel tax groups costs, And also like the assessments, like state data center assessment that's added into that. After removing those costs, then we take out these statutory transfers that come out prior to apportionment. So a good example of that are these like non-highway fuel tax transfers. So where you pay gas tax to use a vehicle or some piece of equipment that's not on a state highway, generally that money is then transferred to whatever agency that kind of oversees the use. So examples are like ATV use, where fuel tax paid for on sand dunes in Southern Oregon, that's overseen by Parks and Rec, so that money is transferred or estimated each year and transferred to Parks and Rec Department. Or the gasoline that's consumed in aviation is transferred to the Department of Aviation, or gasoline that's consumed in motorboats, that goes to State Marine Board. So those are just some examples of these off-the-top transfers that are made. After we make these transfers and deduct these costs, then what's left is an apportion between ODOT and the cities and counties. There's several different apportionment formula that are used depending on the piece of legislation that the revenue is tied to. But in general, we're expecting to transfer about $760 million to the cities and counties in 2013-15 biennium. After that apportionment, then we take what's left and reduce it by debt service. So this is the highway tax bond debt service for our OTIA program, which was that the big packages came earlier in the 2000s, and then our most recently, our JTA, which is the jobs that was passed in the 2009 session. And these are this is the debt service to pay these bonds, and we expect about $360 million in debt service during 13-15 biennium. So after debt service is reduced, what's left then is this like $786 million that's available for ODOT operations. So this is the rest of the people and maintenance and things, the operations that ODOT does. So that should give you an idea of kind of how the money, what we get, start out with these $2.3 billion, how it gets allocated into different places. The next slide then it gives you two different looks of the same total source of revenues, $2.3 billion, but the left-hand one gives you the sources and where this money comes from. As you can see, like the biggest piece, this the blue slice of the pie here, is this motor fuels taxes, and this is gas tax and used fuel tax. About 90% of it's gas tax, about 10% of it's used fuel. We expect there to be about $1 billion in 2013-15 in gross revenues. There's been a lot of sort of discussion recently about the sort of the long-term viability of this as a consistent, stable source of revenue going forward for state transportation revenues. And I'd just like to sort of highlight a couple of sort of the barriers to growth for these gas taxes, because our most recent consumption peak was in calendar year 2006. And generally since that time, we've seen this drop in consumption and fuels consumption. And we had some growth in 2013, but looking ahead, there's a couple big barriers out there that could prohibit us from just sort of getting back onto a track where we were back in the 90s and the 80s when these this fast growth, and that's fuel efficiency, and then these sort of socioeconomic or sociodemographic changes. And fuel efficiency, think about EPA has set these targets, like model year 2016, to have a fuel efficiency equivalent rating of new vehicles of 35.5 miles per gallon. And then by model year 2025, that becomes 54.5 miles per gallon. Those are significant increases over where we are today, which for new vehicles, we estimate it's around like 30 miles per gallon. So that's big jumps. Whether we meet those targets or not, the important thing is that we're trying to meet those targets, that vehicle manufacturers are, and that you'll see much more fuel-efficient vehicles coming into the online in the future. And as you know, if all things held constant, an increase in fuel efficiency, you drive the same amount of miles, you're going to consume less gas. So that means less gas tax. On the social kind of demographic piece to it, we have this boomer generation that is moving into retirement, and we know that their driving patterns are going to be different than when they're in the workforce, and that we're assuming they're going to drive less than what they were when they are driving 5 days a week to their job, and they're more of a leisure focus. They might have longer trips, but they're generally going to be less frequent. And then on top of that, you have this compounding piece that this older generation's retirement age is growing in terms of total size of the total population. So not only are we potentially this boomer generation driving less, but then their total share is growing of population. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got these millennials, these younger people who are getting their license, or, you know, kind of licensed age population to entering the workforce. And there's been a lot of research into what are they doing? What are they thinking? What does their travel behavior look like? And are they driving as much? And there's evidence, so if you look at, like, Oregon's license, you go back as about 15 years, you can see that the 16, 18-year-olds, the total number is dropping each year pretty much in a number of get licenses, and as their share of the total getting a license or has a license. So, and there's a lot of questions as to why. Is it because, you know, the economy has been really poor, and so that we know the employment rate has been high, so it's, you know, 20% is about where we're at now, and for this 16, 18-year-old age. So, and it costs a lot to own and operate a vehicle, so there's that, but, and their parents, as me being one of those that has one of these 16-year-olds, that costs a lot for me to add him to my insurance, so I know that incomes for a lot of the population has been fairly flat, the real income especially. So there's that going on, but there's also this issue of what are their choices? They have technology, access to technology to connect socially that we didn't have. And how does that affect their need to travel to get to a location to, you know, spend time with their friends? Can they do that online through their computer or through their phone that they couldn't do before? So there's a lot of research that's looking into that and how that's going to affect their behavior going forward. But one of the points I wanted to make is that these are all slow to happen. None of this is happening overnight. We're not going to see this cliff where fuel tax revenues are going to drop off, because fuel efficiency, while we're going to see big increases in light vehicle, new light vehicle fuel efficiency, the stock is a different story. To give you context, new vehicle registrations, we register about 120,000 of them a year in Oregon. Our fleet is 3.2 million vehicles. So it's going to take a long time, and the average age is about 11 years of a light vehicle. So it's going to take a long time for these new vehicles to work their way to the system, for the fleet to turn over. And the population piece is the same thing. These changes are slow to happen. So we have, you know, these, on the one hand, you've got these barriers that are slowly preventing this fuel tax piece from growing, but then we also have a population that's increasing, and we are seeing growth in registrations, so which generally means more miles driven and more consumption. So there's these, all these factors that are kind of working against each other going forward, but these are generally really big concerns that we have about sort of this fuel tax being a stable source, consistent going forward. So that's enough about fuel tax. The next piece is the red one, is the weight mile taxes. So this is in lieu of a fuel tax, and it's a weight distance tax then that's paid for trucks that are heavy trucks. These are trucks greater than 26,000 pounds. And the rate that they pay is based on the size of the load and the number of axles on the vehicle. So generally, the smaller number of axles and the higher, the heavier the load, they're going to pay more, because then the theory is they can do more damage to the highway at that point. And we expect about, you know, $560 million in revenue in 2013-15. The green one, we're getting into kind of the DMV piece. The green is vehicle license freeze. This is basically registrations. This is your passenger registrations. This is the heavy truck registrations, buses, trailers. And these are generally don't change a whole lot. They grow really pretty slowly with population and aren't as affected by sort of economic business cycle as you would expect to find with or the weight mile on motor fuels. The gray slice is the other, this other transportation license fees. This is titles mainly. This is when you sell your vehicle, you transfer the title, you pay that fee. Or when you buy a new vehicle, you get a new title fee. There's also like trip permits are in here, and some plate fees are in here. And again, like with the vehicle license fees, doesn't change a whole lot. Although with the recession, it was interesting that we saw a real decrease in new vehicle sales, and it hit hard on new vehicle sales. And so you saw a decrease in new like titles and an increase in new registrations. And that's come back, but we're not back to where we were before the recession. And the last piece is driver's license fees. This is our commercial, non-commercial endorsements for you to drive your vehicles, your Class A, Class C commercial license vehicles, motorcycles. This is like the permits to motorcycle permits, driver's permits, and then like the test fees that you pay. And this is, again, pretty stable source that has some cyclical nature to it because of, like, we renew our license every 8 years, and so there's this kind of this ups and downs that flows with that. The right-hand pie is kind of giving you a different look at this, and it shows these user taxes, which is the combination of the motor fuel taxes and the weight mile taxes, and then the vehicle, driver, and other fees is the combination of that, of the other three pieces of the pie, the green, the gray, and the orange. And I want to bring this because it shows you that user taxes are basically vary by intensity of use. So the more you use the system, the more you pay. So, the more you drive, the more gallons of gas you consume, the more you pay gas tax. The further your trip when you're carrying a load, you're going to pay more weight mile tax. So these are very sensitive. These are dynamic fees or taxes. They're sensitive to the economy, whereas these vehicle driver other fees are more insensitive, more invariant. You're paying for to get access to the system. So your driver's license, your vehicle registration, your title fees, they give you the legal right to be able to drive on the highway network. So it's not as sensitive to changes in the economy, changes in the business cycle as these others are, because you're paying like one time for a title, you're paying every 2 years renew your registration, or 8 years renew your license. And then our last slide gives us a look at sort of the forecast over time. And we've got three lines on here. The top line, the blue line, is giving you the forecast for June 2009. And the reason why I'm giving you this one is because this is the first forecast that included this JTA, the Jobs and Transportation Act revenues. And these were increases in DMV fees, increases in motor carrier fees and taxes, and an increase in the gas tax. And they were implemented in a staggered approach, which is why you don't see just a straight line going up and then over. It's more of a incremental. But below that, this red line, this is our gross highway revenue forecast from our December 2013. And you can see it's lower than the blue line. And as you've had OAA up here giving you forecasts over the last several years, we've heard why. And it's because we expected in June 2009 there to be this sort of quick, robust recovery in the economy that was going to lead to rapid growth in revenues, and obviously that's not what happened. Since then, we've seen this more stop and go type of recovery, and now recently, in 2013, now we're finally getting on track, but it's still slow. It's this expectation for this slow growth going forward. So we have this gap, and we still have the responsibility as ODOT to go forth and complete the projects that were in this JTA legislation, and we're doing that. We're just doing it with a little less revenue than what we projected at the time. And I give you this bottom line, because this, like this JTA revenue, that's dedicated to the projects or to the debt service. And if you take that out, this JTA revenue out, that's what this green line is showing you. It's minus those revenues. And you can see that from 2009, really 2013, it's been flat. Our growth has just, our revenues has been flat during that time. This is nominal revenue, it's not real revenue, so it's not adjusted for inflation. And going forward, you know, we expect there to be about 1.8% growth on average from FY14 through FY19. That's the end of our current forecast. And we're just concerned about how, if our current expectation is that inflation will be eating up that revenue growth, especially in some areas like DMV, where it's very heavy personal service oriented, and we're looking at those personal service inflation increases to be significantly higher than sort of a 4% biennial rate. So I guess with that, that concludes my remarks, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Thank you very much. We very much appreciate it. Questions or comments? Representative Berger.
Could you give me just briefly a scale? You mentioned two things that are changing, the demographics and the fuel. Are they about equal in impact, or is one more or the other?
I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, that right now the fuel efficiency is probably the most serious concern going forward in the near term, but in the longer term, there could be potential for the demographic pieces to be very large. We don't know, like these millennials, we don't know what's going to happen when they start having kids and they have jobs. Are they going to revert to a behavior that is similar to what our travel behavior, or are they going to kind of, they've made some sort of permanent adjustment. Are they not going to continue to drive? And those are just speculation. No one really knows until we get there to be able to measure that, other than just sort of surveying and asking people what they're going to do.
Yep.
One other comment on that, because I'm of that other generation you mentioned, the one that technically is driving less because of aging issues, but I note that there's a new study out that says that they are driving better, longer, older, which gave me hope for driving better, longer, older.
Driving until 90.
Yes, I don't think that particularly requires a response.
No.
Other Representative Vance, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. The green line trends up just a bit, notwithstanding the reductions in use. What's causing the up?
So the increase that you see there, Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, the increase that you see in the green line, this is really a result of we're seeing some growth in 2013 heading into 14 and 15. We do expect some growth to happen in revenues. Weight Mile has had ended their year pretty strong, and so we can expect that to continue. And then, like I said, there was worse growth in motor fuels as well during 2013. So the expectation is now that the economy has sort of gotten onto a track where it's growing, we do expect growth in transportation revenues as well. It's just slow.
A follow-up?
Yeah, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and this, I'm not quite sure this is the question for you, but the shortfall in the JTA revenue projection has to be made up somewhere. And I guess the question is where?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, because we're still doing those projects. What's changed is that we're taking away that money from somewhere else that could have been doing other projects, or we have discretion.
Representative Reed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation, Mr. Porter, and thanks for anticipating the comment and question. Representative Davis and I were debating about the folks as they have kids and whether they're going to be driving more and changing their habits. I wonder if in the process of developing your presentation and your work, you have a chance to look at what other states are doing. Are there developments elsewhere that we should be paying attention to, positive or negative?
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, with regard to types of
policy changes, trends, other things that we should be keeping in mind as we're considering policy choices that might come before us.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Reed. So I was actually just reading an article this morning. One of the things that we're seeing is that the VMT per capita is going down. So whether it's demographics and different choices that people are making. But actually, Maryland DOT is revisiting their long-range transportation plan and making some differing assumptions about what does that mean to their long-range plan. So so there's a couple of states that have started to say, because it's been at the federal level, I think they said, for which gets back to the 2006 date that I think that Daniel pointed out, that for the last 9 years, Federal Highways has seen a decrease in VMT. And so state DOTs are now starting to say, what differing assumptions should we be making? And Maryland apparently is the first one that's starting to really look at that.
Thanks. Representative Berg.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I will be going down in March to talk to some California folks about our road user tax and its implications. And
where are you going, Representative?
Down to California. Okay. And I will be happy to ask in California what their policy sort of anticipatory things are, because it'll be local government. And so, yeah, California.
We hope that
Representative.
Right, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Others? Strictly speaking, the next item is that I would like to raise is not within the direct purview of this committee, but it would be useful, I think, for our planning purposes, and it's not directly related to this report either, so I don't need a response today, but it would be useful, I think, to get a sense of the changes in costs in the construction projects that you're working on. What's the inflation rate, that kind of thing. I don't want an answer today. We're out of time. But that would be useful. And I would simply note also that as alternate fuel vehicles become more prevalent, that also will cut into your revenue estimate. And some of the current projections suggest that that may be fairly precipitous much sooner than most people think. So it's simply a word to the wise, and we'll consider that further. Colleagues, we're past our time for today. I want to thank this panel for the presentation. There's no reason for me not to adjourn, is there? We haven't got anything waiting in the wings. All right. Colleagues, please stay tuned. I think this is our last meeting, but I'm not sure. So check your agendas as they come out, and with that, committee is adjourned.
That's sad.
As they come out, and with that, committee is adjourned.
That's sad.